the hemp plant has various components or fractions, if you will. And only a few of the components or fractions of the hemp plant is actually being harvested and pressed for oil, which is providing the cannabinoid products that we're seeing and that we're paying a lot of money for. But the rest of that plant, again, is pretty cellulosic. It doesn't have a lot of cannabinoids, but the cannabinoids are there. And so what are we going to do with it? We can compost it, we can burn it, we can landfill it, but why not feed it to cattle, especially because we know it's such a sustainable crop and it's going to keep growing.
We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible.
Kemin invites you to optimize animal feed quality and safety with our portfolio of solutions. Learn more at kemin.com/AG. Evonik, we are sciencing the global food challenge.
Hello, and welcome to Feed Science Podcast. I'm your host, Bob Odker, and we're here today to try to learn something interesting and new. And so I'm going to ask my host to introduce herself, and we'll get started.
Hi, Bob. I'm Merritt Drury. I'm an assistant professor in the Department of Agricultural Sciences at Texas State University.
Okay, well, welcome today. And we're going to talk today about some novel feeds for cattle and livestock altogether, but especially beef. So let's start out by asking you how the novel feeds contribute to the sustainability of livestock feeding and production.
Yeah, absolutely. A lot of our listeners know, as I'm sure you do, Bob, that livestock, well, especially cattle, which are ruminants, they don't necessarily eat the grains and other foods that would be suitable for human consumption that you and I consume. They eat a lot of byproduct or co-product feeds. For example, dried distiller's grains from the ethanol industry, right? That is a byproduct of something else, and it would otherwise be wasted if we couldn't utilize it in the livestock feeding sector. So what we're trying to do in our laboratory at Texas State is identify other waste streams from agricultural production or any industry, really. What waste streams are nutrient rich? They don't have a current application, and they could be really well utilized and upcycled by livestock, especially beef cattle.
Well, that makes a lot of sense and a good way to use some of these things up. So let's start out with the BSFL and what you can. I was very interested to learn about that. So
yeah, so BSFL is black soldier fly larva. And what's happening is the insect rearing industry, or the industry that is actually raising insects as mini livestock, it is scaling rapidly at the global level. So there are more and more people that are intentionally raising insects on a mass scale. And there are lots of different insects out there, but the one that's receiving a lot of attention is black soldier fly larva, or as you called it, BSFL. The reasons it's getting a lot of attention is because at the larval stage, BSFL has a lot of protein and a lot of good fat in it as well. And the protein fraction is pretty balanced with essential amino acids. And so what's happening is that these larvae are really good bioconverters. They're very efficient at taking their feed substrate, which can be organic waste biologically, and turning that substrate into their actual larval biomass. And so the insect producers are raising the larva through a certain phase, and then they are processing them, they're drying them, and there are different applications being explored, different industries. But what we're finding is that BSFL is especially interesting as a livestock feed.
And I would ask, I'm interested, you know, you mentioned they dry it. What's the scope, or, you know, like the inclusion rate? I'm a feed mill guy, so I'm kind of interested in, you know, I have a vision of all these fly larvae. How do you, you know, what's it look like? What kind of inclusion rates? How do you feed it?
What it looks like, they're dried as larvae, and most processors are grinding it into a meal. And something I should tell you is that this industry is kind of just scaling, just emerging. So we really don't have these, let's say, standardized protocols yet. Some processors are interested in defatting or extracting the fat and the oil fraction of BSFL, maybe placing it in the human market, maybe pharmaceutical applications for the oil. And that's what I'm really interested in too, is the defatted BSFL biomass. And because it's very protein rich, it doesn't have a lot of fat. And we know that, you know, beef cattle really don't consume a lot of fat naturally. So can we get a very protein rich meal that would be similar to cottonseed meal or something else that would be fed commonly to cattle?
Okay.
To answer your question, what does it look like? It actually does look like physically a meal, but everybody's doing something different. It depends if it has the fat or not. So I think your other question was about inclusion rate in the diet, correct?
That's correct, yes.
We can talk more about the research trials that we have done. We've really used a cow-calf model, if you will. So we've evaluated the BSFL. We've had different BSFL. We've had totally defatted, we've had partially defatted, and we've had full fat meal, just depending on what we can get. And we've evaluated it as a protein source to replace cottonseed meal and soybean meal to cattle consuming forage. So most of the trials, not just in cattle, that are being done in livestock, are evaluating the BSFL as a partial or a complete protein replacement to conventional sources. I haven't done a feedlot trial or a feed yard trial where we're replacing grains in a total mixed ration. If anybody wants to buy me a feed mixer, I'll do that rapidly. I would love to. So I can't answer the question about dietary inclusion and upper limits. That's really another line of inquiry that I'd love to do. I just don't have the infrastructure here quite yet. But we have found that we can do a complete replacement of the protein source to cattle consuming forage without major issues. But of course, that level of dietary inclusion is much, much different than our grain fed animals. So our fed cattle. So I don't think I can totally answer your question, but it's something that I would love to pursue.
And I assume it's cost competitive to these other ingredients as well then, right? It's financially, it's a good choice.
Well, that's another big, question mark and a big open box right now, because as I mentioned, the industry is scaling and emerging. And truly, it feels like we're a little ahead of the industry in our research. And that's pretty typical. We experienced that when we were working on algae 10, 12 years ago, algae as a feed. So right now, the industry has not realized full emergence or full scaling. So the economies of scale aren't quite there. And so can you economically produce BSFL as feed? They feel that they can, but the processes aren't standardized. They aren't there yet. So we actually don't know how much does it cost when we're buying tons of it per day, perhaps. So our research lab did publish a study in 2022, I believe. And it was essentially a hedonic pricing model, and it was answering the question, how much does BSFL need to be marketed at to be cost competitive, such that these ag producers, those feeding the animals, can afford it, can economically integrate it. And so can it be produced at that level? I think that remains to be seen. But we certainly know that BSFL is going to be more competitive or more well-suited in the animal feed application versus human food. And I also feel strongly that to be cost competitive and to be a viable feed, we must extract that oil and market that somewhere else at a very high price point, you know. And I also think that we need to understand what happens to frass. Do you know what frass is?
I do not, no.
Okay. I bet our listeners don't either, but frass is basically like the insect poop, if you will. Okay. So these larvae, as they're being reared, they're shedding their exoskeleton and they're also excreting fecal waste, if you will. And so the frass is produced in probably three times the actual quantity or volume of the larval biomass.
Oh.
And right. And so the frass itself is really nitrogen rich. It's about 20% protein, but it's really chitinous. It has a lot of chitin, which is a really almost like a cellulosic polymer. It's difficult to digest, I guess, because it's that exoskeleton. So my point of all of this is that before we really understand the economic viability of BSFL as feed, we need to understand that oil extraction and the value the oil can capture and what we're going to do with frass so that it's not a waste and that it has an economic contribution too.
Really, you're in the same sort of evolution that DDGS has gone through with.
Absolutely.
What is actually the main product or the byproduct or the co-product, or you're really in the very early stages of figuring those things out.
I think we are. And, you know, I'm excited that the research is a little ahead of the industry because I hope industry's listening right now. And I hope that we can inform them to make good decisions about product placement. And some of our research demonstrates not just in insects, in algae, as I kind of alluded to earlier, but some of our research demonstrates that what happens upstream affects the downstream product. So what they're raising the larva on, what temperature they're drying the larva at, do they extract the oil or not? All of this impacts the value of the product, BSFL, to the livestock producer. And so I think it's important to have these data and be kind of ahead of the curve, if you will, so that insect rearers really understand the importance of their operations and their processes and standardizing those.
Okay. Yeah. And a great point. I think the industry at least is listening. Feed Science Podcast sure is. And so for those of you that are listening today, and if you're seeing something you like, hit the like button or subscribe. And if you know people who'd be interested in this, share it with them, because the whole idea of the podcast here is to share the cutting edge science stuff that's going on in the feed industry. And even old guys like me know that we have to learn new tricks as we go along to stay competitive and to find new ways to feed cattle. So with that said, does that significantly cover the BSFL topic at this point?
I think so. You know, our research group is really the only exploring BSFL and other insects. We've also looked into mealworm larvae. These insect products, I think we're the only ones exploring them in cattle. And so I would love to collaborate. I would love for others to kind of add to this line of inquiry. It's fun to continue to cite ourselves, but we'd like some others to join us in this field and in this area, especially our friends in the dairy world and the feed yard world. So yeah, we totally welcome collaboration, and I think we've covered the BSFL thing.
And for those that are interested, why reach out and find out more? Mm-hmm. Well, so if we've covered that, then we want to talk about hemp today as well, correct?
Sure. Yeah. Like we mentioned, we love using kind of novel and weird feeds. And so I think hemp is becoming super interesting. I don't know what you think.
I think we're all aware that hemp's being grown around commercially a lot more and used for different things. So yeah, how do you see that working into cattle?
Yeah. So hemp, as you just mentioned, it's being grown, and hemp is a really cool crop because it is sustainable in the way that it grows really well. It's really hardy. If there's any hemp growers listening, I think you're probably shaking your head. Yeah, it will grow with in drought conditions, in really hot conditions. Basically, when we've got all this forage around, nothing else is growing, hemp is growing, right?
Right.
And so hemp is being grown because we're allowing it to be grown via the last farm bill. But also it's being grown for different applications. One that I'm really interested in is hemp being grown for the cannabinoids. We're seeing more CBD products in the human application use for our companion animals. And so what's happening is that the hemp plant has various components or fractions, if you will, and only a minority, but only a few of the components or fractions of the hemp plant is actually being harvested and pressed for oil, which is providing the cannabinoid products that we're seeing and that we're paying a lot of money for. But the rest of that plant, again, is pretty cellulosic. It doesn't have a lot of cannabinoids, but the cannabinoids are there. And so what are we going to do with it? We can compost it, we can burn it, we can landfill it, but why not feed it to cattle, especially because we know it's such a sustainable crop and it's going to keep growing. So the big problem historically, though, has been that we cannot allow cannabinoids to enter the animal feed chain because of the transference from the feed into the animal tissues, which then can transfer to you and I as we consume maybe that steak from the grocery store. So we're doing research and we're writing grants that build off some of the research we have going on to basically see, like, what does that cannabinoid transference look like? Is hemp a good nutrient source for cattle? And what do consumers think about it?
So are you saying we could make a 16-ounce gummy or something by mistake? Or
a lot of people have asked that and they're like, actually, this sounds amazing. You know, let's get tallow or animal fat that's CBD rich. And that's not the plan, but that absolutely will happen. That cannabinoid transference is very real. But this field is emerging because AFCO and FDA just in August, just a month ago, voted to allow hemp seed meal to be a defined ingredient for poultry in the U.S. And this established cannabinoid tolerances for CBD and THC to enter the feed chain. And that had never happened before. So that's really exciting. That's hemp seed mill. I'm interested in some different parts of the plant, but that kind of sets the stage to allow hemp to enter the feed chain. But we need to do so safely. And we need to make sure, again, that we, the consumer, are not being exposed to cannabinoids unknowingly or unwittingly.
And do the research to make the general public comfortable with the product, right?
Absolutely. And we actually did publish that, Bob. We published an article in, it's like the Journal of Natural Fibers. It's something like that. And it's called hemp. It's called Consumer Support for Hemp as Feed and Food. And we asked U.S. consumers, a representative population, how they felt about hemp as feed. And a lot of them were incredibly comfortable with it and supported it as long as it did not pose like a health risk to them, the consumer. But a really surprising amount embraced hemp as feed. And they were like, yeah, they didn't see any issues and they thought it was like a really good thing, especially with the environmental sustainability component that's there.
And you've done some trials and fed it to cattle and
yeah,
and know that it's plausible.
Yes, we've done an in vitro, in situ, and in vivo trial. And for anybody who's not an academic, basically we started by doing like test tube trials and now we've actually fed it to cattle. We are developing those data into two manuscripts that we'll submit to journals probably in January, but right now they'll be defended as a master's thesis later this semester. And we want to make sure that cattle would eat it And we wanted to see, I think that our trial was the most robust in terms of looking at the cannabinoid transference through the animal tissues. So we collected fluid from the stomach. We collected a lot of plasma samples, a lot of fecal samples, and importantly, we collected fat tissue samples over time, longitudinally. And we wanted to know if animals consumed hemp and were exposed to cannabinoid, kind of what is the withdrawal period, if you will, if we're going to treat this like a drug, like how long does it take to clear from the animal system, or at least to get to a level that now that we have established tolerances, maybe a level in the tissues that FDA deems as safe. And so, yeah, we have those data. We're so excited to present them, but they're not out there yet. We've presented them at conferences and things like that, but they're not like in the public sphere yet.
Is there anything else we need to know today about feeding hemp to cattle?
No, really, not so much. You know, just that work is underway. And I think that, you know, the everyday consumer needs to understand that there are processes in place to ensure that nothing that poses a health risk or something like that to them, that won't happen. And so, you know, sometimes it seems like research and science takes a long time, and it's all to just safeguard public health. And so I think the consumers who appreciate our research, and I know a lot of these listeners are in the feed world. So just keep your eye on hemp and BSFL both. I think that they're both really important areas of research that will enhance the sustainability of livestock production.
It's time for our famous three.
Okay, well, I will certainly do that and encourage our viewers to do the same. So with wrapping that up then, I've got three questions that I always like to ask to get a little extra information and insight. So the first one would be, I'm interested in what your favorite resource or, you know, go-to book or person or whatever it is, you know, inside the feed livestock spectrum. What's your favorite go-to?
It just depends. I know you sent me these questions ahead of time, and I like intentionally didn't look at them because I didn't want you to get a rehearsed response. Now I'm regretting that. No, where I go, it really depends on what the question or what I'm looking to understand. I may go to my mentor, who happens to be a professor at Texas A&M University. I may go to friends I have that work in various positions in the industry. But let me tell you who I'd love to go to, and I don't have that great of a line on. I'd love to go to actual, like, you know, the producers, because when I do get to talk to them, I'm like, what is the real issue for you? Or what is a question you want answering? And I think that we in research don't do that enough. And then we find ourselves 5 years down the road of this inquiry, this research that really doesn't matter for the producer. So as much as I can, I try to talk to the actual producer to understand. And students too, sometimes when I am just totally stuck or I need an idea or something like this, I talk to them because they have such great ideas and they have such creative ways of thinking. So I wouldn't say I have one source. I really just try to talk to everybody and everyday consumers. Sometimes when I talk to my family, who's very much not in this world, but I talk to them about my research, they ask me a question and I'm like, wow, that's a really, like, how insightful. And that will spur a whole new research project. So I think people are my resource.
That works.
I mean, your podcast is, Bob, right? Was that the right answer?
Well, yes. You should always use Feed Science Podcast as a resource. Absolutely. So what's your favorite book or resource, you know, outside of agriculture? So like a personal resource or book you'd go to if on a regular basis, if you do.
Yeah, I don't think I have a go-to. I've been wanting to reread Lab Girl lately. So if you're looking for a book to read, Lab Girl is a really good one. Anything by Mary Roach is also phenomenal. So those are great books, but usually I'm reading to kind of defrag and to relax, but both of those are kind of sciencey and researchy and awesome. And also The Secret Life of Henrietta Lacks, phenomenal for those other researchers or scientists out there.
And so then let me ask you one last question. So within, you know, your area here, let's say research, R&D, you know, pushing boundaries, that kind of stuff. What do you think separates the people that are successful from those that are not successful?
Oh, that is a great question. Wow. I think that what makes a good researcher, you know, is the ability to be wrong and the ability to be okay with being wrong. When I'm training students, a lot of what I do is more teaching and mentoring students, especially undergrads. I'm really passionate about it. And I can always tell who's going to be the boundary pusher, if you will, versus not, because they don't get frustrated with being quote unquote wrong. And I don't think you're ever wrong in research, but sometimes we will try to figure out a method or we'll do all of this reading and then it's not answering the question we want. And we feel that it's a waste of time, but it's not. It just taught us what not to do. Or we do this whole study and all of our findings are not significant. And then the student's like, oh, this is a waste of time. And it's like, no, we need to publish that because it tells somebody else what not to do. So I really think what makes a good thinker and a good scientist and researcher is embracing not having all the answers, not being right, as long as they're learning and continuing to improve and continuing to put themselves out there and think. I think they're phenomenal.
There's really nothing quite as satisfying as pouring in or mentoring somebody who wants to be mentored, right?
Yeah. Also, right. The trainability. Yeah.
Yeah. That's receptive. Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, with that, we'll conclude this episode of our Feed Science podcast. We'll say goodbye to our viewers here. So, this podcast is presented by Wisenetics, and we appreciate you taking the time to join us, and we hope that you have a nice day and that God blesses you in all you do.
Do you feel overwhelmed with mundane tasks that eat up your valuable time? It's time to reclaim your schedule and focus on what truly matters. Get your time back with elite remote talent from Brazil without a time zone hassle. Delegate $10 an hour tasks to focus on your $1,000 an hour tasks. Schedule your free strategy call at wisevas.io.